The queen nodded slowly, a thread of disquiet worming through her belly. Another low hiss came from the direction of the fireplace. She whirled, but there was nothing there. Stop falling to pieces. The double doors to the throne room opened with a creak of wood. And there, finally, was Ducat, still wrapped in his travelling cloak. He dragged a prisoner behind him, chained and hooded.
"My apologies for the delay, Majesty," he called across the room, "but I bring you a gift."
"Bring it quickly, then, Benin. We've been waiting for you." Ducat hauled the prisoner forward, heedless of the man's groans as the manacles bit into his bloody wrists. Ducat's nose and cheeks were still reddened with the morning cold, and his black hair was beginning to thin on top. But when he reached the table and turned his heavy-lidded eyes to the queen, she found herself comforted, as always, by the dark confidence she found there. Here, at least, was a man she would never need to doubt.
"What have you brought me this time, Benin?"
Ducat jerked off the prisoner's hood. The man straightened and blinked in the torchlight, and the queen's spirits lifted as though infused with helium. It was General Genoux.
"I found him hiding out in Arc Pearl, Majesty," Ducat announced, tossing the end of the chain to Lieutenant Vice as he removed his cloak. "In the basement of a knockhouse, and not a wound on him either."
The Queen gazed at Genoux, considering. 2,000 dead in a surprise attack on his watch. It would be good to make an example of him. But not a public example. As yet, few in Mortmain knew of the disaster out on the flats, and she wanted to keep it that way. Still, it never hurt to remind her war council who was in charge here. Sometimes they tried to forget.
"We behead our deserters, Vincent, but a general who fails so spectacularly and then deserts? I believe you're a special case."
"Majesty," Genoux protested, "I carry extensive knowledge of the army, of tactical planning. I did not want my knowledge to fall into tear hounds."
"How noble of you. And which ignorant but well-meaning whore agreed to take you in?"
Genoux shook his head, but when the queen turned to Ducat, he nodded.
"Good. Have her executed."
"Majesty, there was nothing I could have done," Genoux cried. "The attack, it came so suddenly."
The queen ignored the rest. She had slept with Genoux once, years ago, when he was only a lieutenant, and a different woman might have taken that into consideration. But the queen was already sifting through her memories. Genoux had been talkative after sex, babbling endlessly while she tried to sleep. It was one of the reasons she had never invited him back for a repeat performance. The queen wasn't the only one afraid of fire these days. Genoux's childhood home had burned down, and he had narrowly escaped being caught inside the flaming building, taking several bad burn wounds in the process. The incident had left its mark on the adult Vincent, who still had a deep-rooted horror of fire, of being burned. The queen leaned forward, lacing her fingers together, and stared into Genoux's eyes. He wrung his bound hands, trying to look away, but it was too late. Something had woken inside the queen, a hungry, grasping rage that travelled her bloodstream, igniting individual nerves. She sensed Genoux's body, tasted the contours of it, a soft mass of vulnerable cells in her hands. Dimly, she sensed her security council shifting uncomfortably around the semicircle. Martin crossed his legs, looking down at the floor. Valet had actually turned away to stare into the dark fireplace. Only Ducat was really watching Genoux, his expression the same as on those rare occasions when the queen allowed him to observe in her laboratory. Alert and interested, curious to see what would happen next. Genoux began to scream. He tore his gaze from hers, but the queen had him now, and she bore down harder, feeling his skins a thick, malleable fabric of flesh that darkened and burned in the oven of her mind. His body blackened before her, the skin charring and crisping until the Queen knew that she could turn him inside out and shed his skin as easily as if he'd been a pig on a spit. The military men were unable to ignore the spectacle. Even those who tried to look away now stared at Junot, transfixed, as his howls echoed between the walls of the audience chamber. The Queen went to work on his vitals, and Junot fell to the ground, his screams quieting till he could only emit a shallow gargling. His heart was the easiest thing of all, a thick wall of muscle that the Queen tore through as though it were paper, lacing it with fire and then shredding it apart. She felt the moment when he died, the connection between them breaking sharply inside her head. She turned back to the rest of them, looking for argument. The fire inside her was ravenous now, difficult to control. It cried out for another target. But none of them would meet her eyes. Only a charred, vaguely manlike shape remained on the floor. A throat cleared behind her. The Queen whirled, delighted. But it was only Beryl, his face expressionless, holding out an envelope. The Queen fought down the thing inside her, but it didn't go easily. She was forced to tamp it down, as one would extinguish a fire, stomping and kicking until it was only ashes. As her pulse returned to normal, she felt both relief and regret. She rarely used this particular talent, understanding that repetition would lessen its impact on others. But it was a wonderful feeling to let go and give free rein to her anger. There were so few opportunities now. She took the envelope from Beryl, noting that he'd already opened it, and read the enclosed note, unease deepening inside her with every word. All of the satisfaction of the previous few minutes had evaporated now, and she was suddenly afraid. "You're going back to the north, Martin. A fire has destroyed the central barracks in Cité Marche." "What kind of fire, Majesty?" "Unknown." "How many dead?" 56 so far. Likely more buried in the rubble. Someone barricaded the doors from the outside." Her commanders stared at each other in wide-eyed silence. "You're dismissed, all of you, except Ducat. Go and take care of this mess and bring me the heads of those responsible." Martin spoke up, an audible quaver in his voice. "The army needs a new commander, Majesty." "Dismissed." They leapt from their seats. Each took a wide path around the charred corpse of Junot, and the Queen restrained herself from smirking. There would be no more griping, complaints, or secret meetings from this bunch for a while. "Shall I remove that, Majesty?" asked Beryl, nodding toward the corpse. "After we're done." Beryl ushered the soldiers out, the oak double doors closing behind him. Only the Queen and Ducat remained.
"Well, Benin, you know what I'm going to ask of you."
"I would have thought you'd want me in the Cité Marche, Majesty. A barracks doesn't burn flat without inside help. There's conspiracy here."
"What do you know of this, Livia?"
"Well, I've heard the name a few times in interrogation. No one seems to know what he looks like or how old he is, which is a bad sign. Whoever the bastard is, he's prudent as well as cunning. The terrorist tactics we've seen recently are new, well planned and designed to inflict maximum damage."
"These are severe security problems, Majesty."
"Severe," she agreed reluctantly.
"And I know you're the best man to solve them, Benin."
"But I can't put any of them," she gestured toward the door, "in charge of the army. It's been too long since we went to war, and none of them are experienced enough."
"We can put that second-in-command of yours in charge of Cité Marche while you're gone. He seems capable to assist Martin. But I need you on the border."
I'm getting a little old to go off to the front again, Majesty, and I've grown to enjoy my current job.
She sighed.
What do you want, Benin? 10% of plunder.
Done.
Not done,
Dukat smiled, a vulpine smile that slid like ice along her spine.
Also, first pick of the children from Carare and Calais. There aren't enough since the tier shipment stopped, and I've been losing out lately to Madame Arnault. She's made some sort of underhanded arrangement with the auctioneer's office.
The Queen nodded slowly, staring at the floor, ignoring the taste of bile in her throat.
You'll have them. Then we're agreed. Any special instructions?
Push the tier out of the hills and into the Almont. We can't cross the border anywhere else.
Why not simply flank them? Go farther north, toward the Fairwitch.
No, the Queen replied firmly. I don't want the army within 100 miles of the Fairwitch. Steer clear. He shrugged.
You know best, Majesty. Give me a few days to tidy some loose ends here and send valet to let the border know I'm coming. I don't want to have to settle any questions of rank when I arrive.
Dukat swung his cloak over his shoulders.
Incidentally, one thing does keep coming up about the rebel leader, this Le Vieux.
Yes?
His accent, Majesty. Several prisoners have mentioned it. It's well hidden. But the man's enunciation says he isn't Mort. He's Tyr.
What would a Tyr be doing fomenting rebellion in Cité Marche?
I could find that out for you, Majesty. But no, I'm heading to the Western Front.
The Queen opened her mouth to reprimand him, and then closed it as he left the room in a swirl of cold air and black cloak. Yet even this exit, abrupt and disrespectful, was comforting. Dukat would find a way to dislodge the Tyr from the border hills. He was a ruthless strategist. Dukat was the commander she needed now, but her unease resurfaced almost immediately after his departure. Why had the Dark Thing forbidden her to invade? Did it shield the girl? An unpleasant suspicion crossed her mind. Perhaps the Dark Thing valued the girl. Perhaps it valued her the same way it had once valued the Queen herself. With the Dark Thing's help, she had ascended to great dominion, but she had always known that this assistance was not free. In return, she was to find a way to set it free from its confinement in the Fairwitch. But she had reached the limit of her powers, at least until she got hold of the Tyr sapphires. If the Dark Thing had no more use for her, then she held no leverage at all. Counting off problems in her mind, the Queen realized that she was in trouble. The Mort army had been humiliated out on the flats. The Dark Thing was moving beyond its own borders. The rebels in Cité Marche had found themselves a leader, a cunning Tyr leader with no face. The Queen's mind gnawed away at these new developments, repeatedly biting down on each of them as one would bite down on a canker, relishing the pain but finding no solution. Around the corner, in the hallway that led to the stairwells, the slave girl Emily straightened from her crouch in the deep shadows. She had come to Domaine in the previous October's shipment, but she had never faced the auctioneer's block. Two men, both of them very polite, had chosen her from the cage, stripped her, and inspected her thoroughly. For lice or some deformity, Emily supposed, before placing her in a wagon with several other male and female slaves, all of them bound for the Palais. Emily was a tall woman, pretty but well-muscled, just the way the Red Queen liked her female slaves. That was why she had been chosen. Emily missed her parents, her brothers and sisters, longed for them every day. But that longing paled in significance beside the fact that none of them would ever be hungry again. After a quick look in each direction, Emily moved lightly down the hallway, her face a pleasantly stupid mask, in case she was intercepted, her mind already composing a message to the mace.
Glyn Queen?
Kelsey dropped her pen, startled. She was alone in the library today, a rare occurrence. Father Tyler was supposed to be here, but he had sent his regrets, unexpected illness. Penn was with her, of course, but he didn't really cut into Kelsey's solitude. And anyway, he had nodded off on a nearby sofa while Kelsey worked. If Mace should walk in, he would give Penn hell for napping. But Kelsey was just as happy to have him get some sleep. Now, as the thin, lisping voice spoke again, Penn jerked awake.
"You ride toward death, Glyn Queen?"
Kelsey turned and saw Andalai's youngest daughter standing before her. The child was tiny, a pixie, really. Fine-boned, like Andalai, with dark hair that grew in a close cap around her head. Kelsey hesitated. She was never sure how to deal with children. The best she could seem to do was talk to them like tiny adults. But then she saw that the girl's eyes, as grey as her mother's, were distant and unfocused. Her usually ruddy face, all of Andalai's children seemed to have taken their father's complexion, was pale now, a milky luminescence in the candlelight. The girl was no taller than Kelsey's work desk, little more than a toddler. But Kelsey felt a sudden urge to back away.
"I see you, Glyn Queen,"
Glee lisped.
"I see you riding toward death."
Kelsey turned a questioning glance to Penn. Glee was supposed to stay with Andalai or Marguerite at all times. But even Kelsey knew that there was a wraith-like quality about this particular child. Mace said she was a sleepwalker, and several times Glee had been found wandering the Queen's wing in unexpected places, even rooms that were supposed to be locked. But Mace had said nothing about what Kelsey was seeing now. The girl wasn't sleepwalking, for her eyes were open and staring. She didn't seem to know where she was. Kelsey got up from her desk.
"Glee, can you hear me?"
"Don't touch her, lady," Penn warned.
"Why not?"
"She's in a trance, just like you were a week ago. Andalai told us not to touch or disturb you. I don't think we should touch the girl."
"The Queen of Spades,"
Glee murmured hollowly, staring straight through Kelsey to the wall beyond.
"Crossing. A dead hand grasping and empty."
"The dead hand."
Kelsey paused at that, for "dead hand" translated roughly into mortmain. Several members of the guard, notably Corin, had taken to asking Andalai when they needed advice on something uncertain, health or weather, or women. Whether Andalai would answer was another matter entirely. She dismissed questions that she considered beneath her, and she adamantly rebuffed all of Arliss's clever attempts to elicit information on coming betting events. Andalai had the sight all right, but here was something Kelsey had never considered, that her children might have it too. Glee moved forward until she was only a foot away, and Kelsey reached out to block her before they collided.
"Don't touch her, Majesty."
Andalai had entered the library just as soundlessly as her daughter.
"Leave her alone, please. I will handle it."
Kelsey scrambled backward. Andalai knelt in front of her daughter, speaking softly. And Kelsey, who had always assumed that Andalai loved all of her children fiercely and equally, suddenly saw that she had been wrong. Andalai did have a favourite child. It was clear in her face, her hands, the quiet tone of her voice.
"You're in a dark place, my poppet," Andalai murmured gently. "And you must come out. You can follow me."
"I can follow you, Maman,"
Glee repeated in her child's lisp.
"Follow my voice, poppet. See the light,
and then you can wake.
Glee stood, staring blankly, for a few more moments. Then she blinked, staring up at her mother with wide eyes.
Maman?
And here you are, Poppet. Welcome back. Glee climbed into Andalai's arms. Andalai sat down on one of the sofas and began to rock the girl, who appeared to already be falling asleep. Pen, leave us alone, and make sure we're not disturbed. Pen left, shutting the door behind him.
I apologize, Majesty, Andalai murmured quietly. My Glee is not like my others. I can have both eyes on her, and a moment later, she's gone.
Kelsey paused for a moment.
Does she have your sight, Andalai?
Yes. She's too young to control it. I've been trying to train her, but it is difficult to find time alone, so that my other children will not be jealous. Glee still doesn't know how to differentiate between what should be said and what should be kept to herself.
I'm sure she'll learn.
She will. But the sooner the better. A child like Glee makes a valuable prize.
She's safe from me, Andalai.
I'm not thinking of you, Majesty.
Andalai continued to rock her daughter, her gaze thoughtful.
Even before my Glee was to go in the shipment, her father had already begun planning a way to use her. His spoken thoughts went no further than dragging her to the dogfights for his own benefit. But I saw the possibility of sale in his mind. He may have told others about Glee.
I see.
As always, Kelsey had to fight a morbid curiosity about Andalai's marriage.
Was it equally hard for you, as a child?
Even worse, lady. For I had no one to guide me through it. My mother sent me away for fostering when I was newly born.
Like me,
Kelsey thought, surprised. Andalai and her children were so tightly knit that Kelsey had never imagined Andalai raised in anything but a close family.
For a long time, my foster parents thought I was merely mad. They treat these things with great suspicion in Mortmain.
Despite the Red Queen?
Perhaps because of her, lady. The Mort are a science-minded people. They hate what the Red Queen can do, yes, but she is too powerful for them to hate the woman herself. Ordinary Mort quickly learn to hide such gifts.
Lazarus tells me, though it's only a rumor in the palais, that the Red Queen's laboratories have been working on the site. They wish to find out if it's genetic.
Andalai smiled, her expression brittle. Trust me, lady. It is. My mother was one of the most powerful seers of our age. My gifts are only a shadow of hers. And I am terribly afraid, Majesty, that Glee is more my mother than me. It will make the world very dangerous for her.
In what way?
Andalai considered her thoughtfully for a moment. We have trust, lady, you and I.
I trust you with my life, Andalai.
Then I will tell you a story. I cannot speak to the truth of the entire story, you understand, for some of it is Mort legend, but instructive nonetheless. There is a woman, a plain wife, who lives on the edge of the Forêt Envanouie. Her life is uneventful. She has grown bored with her husband, a miner. She does not like keeping house. She has nothing to occupy her mind until one day a fortune-teller comes to the village. He is handsome, this fortune-teller, and he does parlor tricks, reads palms, offers charms, even carries an ancient crystal ball. But his tricks are very good, and he is no stranger to bored wives in small towns. The woman is enchanted, and enchantment makes her foolish. 9 months later, the fortune-teller is long gone. But a child is born, a child as different from the woman's other children as can be. This child can predict the weather, knows when visitors approach the village. Useful information for a community, certainly. But the child's gifts reach even further. She can see not only the future, but the past and present, the truth of things. She knows when people are lying. She is a boon to her tiny mining village, and the village prospers, far out of proportion to others in the surrounding countryside. And yet the villagers are extremely foolish. They talk freely about the child. They praise her to the skies. They brag about her in Cité Marche, not thinking of the fact that their country has a new queen now, a queen who believes that she has a right to anything she can grab. And one day, inevitably, soldiers come to the village and take the girl away. She's a commodity, you see, just as valuable as a good assassin or spymaster. More valuable, even, for her gifts only sharpen as she reaches adolescence. She lives a gilded life in Demain, but still she is a prisoner, destined to sit at the right hand of the queen until she dies.
The Red Queen's old seer, Kelsey realized. Dead now. Carlin had spoken of her several times. What was her name?
And yet, for all that, the woman is not entirely subservient. She has a secret life, you comprehend, and she is so clever, so gifted that she is able to hide that life even from the Queen of Mortmain, who has the most feared surveillance apparatus since the old États-Unis. The seer has a man. She conceives a child. Yet she knows the child will never be safe. Her mistress, the queen, is interested in heredity. Even if the child shows no gifts at all, it will spend its life in a laboratory, subject to horrors. So the seer smuggles her newborn girl from the palais. She gives the baby to good people. So she thinks. Kind people. They live in the Jardin, one of the poorest sections of Demain. They've always wanted a child. The baby will be safe there. And yet here the mother's sight has failed her. A child does have her mother's gifts, sporadic and inconsistent, yes. But there, she too can predict the future, see the present. Sometimes she can even see other people's thoughts as clearly as if they were her own. Such a child would always hold a dangerous value. When her adoptive parents fall into debt and need quick money to keep from losing all they own, they sell her to a man in the neighborhood, a man who has always coveted the child. Not for the usual reasons, you understand. He is a businessman, and he wants her sight for the market. She is a tool to him, and when she cannot perform, she is beaten. Kelsey swallowed.
How did you get out?
I made my own great mistake, lady. There was a boy, a tear slave whose masters lived next door to mine. He was a stupid boy, but persistent. He began coming around when I was 10 years old, and he would not take no for an answer. He told me of the tear. Told me that we could escape and live a free life here. I had no interest in the boy. But when I was 15, my owner fell on hard times, and he had no leisure to market my particular gifts. He planned to sell me to a knock house.
Is that?
Anderlei nodded. In your tear, Majesty, a whorehouse. Faced with that, I turned to the tear boy. I thought him harmless.
Anderlei looked down at her daughter, who was fast asleep now, breathing easy.
Always my sight seems to fail when it is most crucial that it should function. Borwin raped me the first night out of Demain, and every night after that. We were on foot, and I could not outrun him.
By the time we reached the Tierling, I already knew that I was carrying. I did not speak the language, but even if I had, Borwen had misled me about the nature of opportunity in the Tierling. For all of its terrors, Mortmain at least allows a competent woman to earn her living without being on her back. Many Mort women are miners or artisans. But I saw very quickly that there were no such options in the Tierling. Borwen is strong. He quickly found work. But I could find none, Majesty. Andalai's voice was rising, and Kelsey realized, horrified, that Andalai seemed to be trying to justify herself, to ward off some inevitable condemnation. No 15-year-old can make good decisions, Andalai. I can barely make easy decisions for my own life now. Perhaps, Majesty, but had I known that my children would also pay for my mistakes, I would gladly have taken the Knock House. I knew that Borwen was a brute, but I didn't realize precisely what he was until Isha was 5 years old. I tried to send both Isha and Wen away, but we had no friends who would take them to safety. Heaven help me, I even tried our local priest to see if he would take them for fostering in lieu of the tithes. But the priest told Borwen what I had done. Finally, I tried to run away, but it is difficult to disappear with children, and it seemed that I was always pregnant. Each time Borwen found me, and if I refused to come home, he would snatch one of the children. In the end, it seemed better to keep them with me. At least I could help them, shield them somewhat.
That seems reasonable, Kelsey ventured, not knowing whether it was true.
What she was hearing now was so far beyond her own experience that she couldn't begin to imagine what she would have done. Her mind skipped back to the pre-crossing woman, Lily Mayhew. Lily had wanted to run, but as a lone woman there was no safety for her to run to. The crossing was more than 3 centuries past, but that world suddenly seemed very close, separated by only a thin veil of time.
Great God, Kelsey thought bleakly, are we really no better?
Perhaps it was reasonable, lady, Andalai mused, and yet my children suffered, and badly. The boys took beatings, the girls took worse. My husband is not a clever man, but his very stupidity makes him dangerous. He has never asked himself whether he has the right to do the things he has done. He is not intelligent enough to consider such questions. This, I think, is the crux of evil in this world, Majesty. Those who feel entitled to whatever they want, whatever they can grab. Such people never ask themselves if they have the right. They consider no cost to anyone but themselves.
Surely part of that is upbringing, Kelsey objected. It can be eradicated.
Perhaps, lady. But I believe Borwen was born as he is. Andalai looked down at Glee, who was fast asleep now, her mouth rounded into an O. I know what my girl has received from me, but I fear constantly what the rest may have taken from their father. I'm not sure whether Isha's temperament comes from Borwin's blood or his mistreatment. The boys have their own problems. Kelsey bit her lip, then ventured.
Lazarus tells me that Isha has real skill, particularly with a knife. Venna enjoys teaching her, certainly more than he ever did me.
Andalai made a face. It's not what I would have wished for, Her Majesty. The fighting. But I see now that her problems are beyond my ability to repair. I appreciate that you have given her this outlet. Perhaps it will ease some of her anger.
Don't thank me. The idea came from Lazarus.
Ah. Andalai shut her mouth, an entire conversation there. Andalai and Mace were unlikely allies, thoroughly disapproving of nearly everything about each other. Kelsey considered saying something else, but Andalai's next remark seemed deliberately abrupt, designed to close the previous topic, as though she were slamming shut a book.
"My Glee's visions may be unfocused yet, lady, but I would advise you to take heed of them."
"In what way?"
"The Mort problem torments you, lady. You are not sleeping. You have lost an alarming amount of weight."
"So Andalai sees it too." Kelsey didn't know whether to be relieved or not.
"I have considered the problem as well. I see no solutions. The Mort army is too strong. But Glee and I see the same common elements in your future. A hand holds your two jewels, but the hand is somehow empty at the same time. A beguiling man whose face conceals a monstrosity. A playing card, the Queen of Spades. A chasm beneath your feet."
"And what does all of that mean?"
"I can't say, lady."
"Then I'm not sure what good it does me."
"Often no good at all, Majesty. It's a mistake made by many to place too much faith in visions. But I would urge you to remember these elements, for they may prove useful when you least expect it. That has been my experience."
Kelsey considered these things one by one. The Queen of Spades. Once a week, Kelsey played poker with five of her guard, and she knew the Spade Queen well. A tall, proud woman with a weapon in each hand. But what of that? Only one of Andalai's omens really seemed to mean anything.
The beguiling man.
That could easily be the fetch. But despite all that she knew of him, Kelsey did not believe him to be monstrous. Her instincts had failed her several times since she had taken the throne. But she refused to believe that they could fail so badly as that. The fetch had his own agenda, certainly, but he made no effort to beguile. Kelsey had done that to herself.
"Be careful, Majesty," Andalai cautioned. "I know your dark-haired rogue. I speak of another. Handsomer sin, this one. But beneath the facade is a horror, and suffering comes with him. Be on your guard."
Not sure how much of this she really believed, Kelsey nodded. She looked down at the sleeping child in Andalai's arms and felt anew the massive weight of responsibility on her shoulders. So many individual lives to look out for each day, and arching above all, the great Mort nightmare on the horizon. It was a heavy responsibility, but it was Kelsey's, and even in her most self-pitying moments, she recognized that she had bargained for it. If she had known everything on that late afternoon when the guards rode up to the cottage, she would still have come. And now it was her burden to bear, all the way to the end.
What end?
Kelsey didn't know, but one of Andalai's images stayed with her, ruining her concentration for the rest of the afternoon. The Queen of Spades.
"Sir?"
Hall looked up, startled. The razor slipped in his hand, scraping jaggedly along his jaw, and he hissed in annoyance.
"What is it, Blazer?"
"Scouts are back, sir. There's a problem."
Hall sighed and wiped the lather from his face, smiling wryly. It seemed that every time he tried to get in a shave lately, there was a problem. Throwing the towel into the corner of his tent, he grabbed his spyglass from the table beside his cot and ducked outside.
"What is it?"
"Five men rode out of the Western Varin round dawn, sir. We thought they were messengers, but we've been tracking them all the same."
"And?"
"Lou's pretty sure now, sir. It's Dukat."
Hall's stomach sank. The news was not wholly unexpected, but it was bad all the same.
"Benin the Butcher."
Hall would much rather have dealt with Jeannot, but Jeannot hadn't been seen in camp since the attack. He was dead, or fled, and there would be no more easy victories. Blazer looked uneasy as well, so Hall forced a smile and clapped him on the shoulder.
How far away?
A few hours, at most. Hall trained his spyglass on the sprawling mess of tents below. He and his men had gotten plenty of entertainment watching the Mort clear the camp. The Rattlers were crafty bastards, their sense of self-preservation not at all impacted by the sudden removal from their hillside rookeries, and having fed well, they'd gone to ground, finding the best hiding places in the camp and sleeping during the day. At night, the screams continued, a steady diet. For the first 2 weeks, Hall had been pleased to see the Mort camp lit up like a Christmas tree at night. They must have used up the lion's share of their ready oil. But more food and oil always came, an unrelenting stream of supply from the southeast, and snakes or no, the cannons remained heavily guarded in the middle of the campsite. Dozens of plans for dealing with them had been heard and discarded, and Blazer and Major Caffrey often ended up shouting at each other until Hall ordered them to shut up. These were signs he could read. Despite the victory they had scored, morale was beginning to fail. Hall refocused his spyglass on the foot of the hill where the Mort had piled their dead in an enormous pyre. This pyre had burned for the past week. Even now, wisps of smoke still drifted into the air from the charred remains. The smell had been bad, and Hall had been forced to change shifts at double time. But now the camp was entirely cleared of the dead, and Mort soldiers leaned against tents, chatting, their shirts off to absorb the June sunlight. Three separate groups of soldiers were hunched over tables, downing pint after pint of ale while they played cards. Hall even saw one soldier sunbathing atop a supply wagon. Still excursionists on vacation. The Mort had tried several assaults on the foot of the hill, but found themselves repelled by Hall's archers each time. In the absence of Jeannot, or another general, these attacks were poorly planned, disorganized in execution. Hall could see them coming a mile away, but that would not last. He turned his spyglass east and found the party easily, a clutch of dark-clad figures moving slowly and steadily across the flats. He couldn't make out their features, but there was no reason to doubt Lew, who'd been born with a built-in spyglass of his own. Hall had never fought Ducart himself, but he'd heard plenty from Bermond, whose reminiscences about the Mort general could chill the blood.
"Ducart will be more inventive," Hall remarked. "And much more trouble."
"If they try to flank us to the north, we can't hold them," Blazer cautioned. "It's too much ground to cover."
"They won't flank."
"How do you know, sir?"
"The mace has a source in the Palais. The Mort have orders to avoid the Fairwitch, even the foothills. It's this stretch or nothing."
Hall set down his spyglass. His palms were sweating, but he hoped that Blazer hadn't noticed.
"Put fresh men in the trees and tell them not to let their eyes wander. Any changes in the Mort sentry line come directly to me."
Blazer left, humming to himself, and Hall began to shave again, though his hand wasn't quite as steady this time. He drew the razor down his bare jaw and felt the blade slice through his skin. Hall had no people. His parents had died several years ago, victims of a winter fever that had swept through all of the villages on the hillside. But what faced the tier now was infinitely worse, and Ducart's arrival only darkened the outlook further. In the last invasion, according to Bermond, Ducart had liked to throw his tier prisoners into pens with starving bears. There would be no mercy for the taken, not even the wounded. And part of Hall could not help wondering whether the Queen had considered these eventualities before she had violated the treaty and opened the door wide. The Queen had brought this upon them, and for a rogue moment Hall cursed her, sitting safely on her throne back in New London. There was some
Bible story, Hall remembered vaguely from his childhood. Something of a little man who took on a giant and emerged victorious. Yet the Mort were 10 giants. Even after Hall's victory 2 weeks ago, the Mort army still had more than 4 times the men, enough to divide and crush the Tyr army from multiple angles. The Queen had not thought of her soldiers, only of principle. And principle was cold comfort to men who were going to die. Hall wondered if she truly had magic, as the rumours said, or whether that was simply a fairy tale that the mace had allowed to spread. The rumours were difficult to reconcile with the woman who sat on the throne, the child adult with the gaze of an owl. Hall had already made his military assessment. All was lost. But intuition was not logical, and his gut would not allow him to give up.
"She could save us," he thought stubbornly. "She could."
Chapter 4 Matters of Conscience.
"Flee. We are in the hands of a wolf." Giovanni de Medici, upon the ascension of Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI.
Father Tyler should have been at ease. He was reading, sitting in the comfortable chair at his desk, and reading usually calmed him, reminded him that there was a world beyond this one, a better world that seemed almost tangible. But this was the rare day when reading calmed nothing. Tyler had covered the same 2 pages several times before he finally put down his book and gave up. A candle on his desk was covered with dried drips of wax, and without thinking, Tyler began to peel them off. His fingers worked independently of his brain, peeling and peeling as he stared out the window. The Holy Father had died 2 weeks ago, on the last day of May. Cardinal Anders had succeeded him, in a conclave so short that a few of the more distant cardinals arrived to find him already in the Holy Father's seat. The Holy Father, recognizing a political mind as sharp as his own, had hand-picked Anders as his successor years ago, and everything had proceeded as it should. But Tyler was afraid. The new Holy Father had attended to many things since taking the robes. He immediately fired 5 cardinals, men with known reformist sympathies, men who'd spoken against Anders during his tenure. Their sees went to nobles' sons for more than £1,000 each. The new Holy Father had also hired 16 new bookkeepers for the Arvath, increasing the total to 40. Some of these new bookkeepers were not even ordained men. Several of them looked and sounded as though the Holy Father had plucked them right off the streets of the gut. Tyler and his brothers had heard nothing, but the conclusion was clear. More money would be coming in. Then there was Tyler's own position. The old Holy Father had been too preoccupied with fighting death to take Tyler to task. But Tyler knew that he would not escape the new Holy Father's house-cleaning attentions for long. Already, last Sunday, Tyler had found Anders' eyes seeking him out in the crowd during the convocation. Anders wanted information on Queen Kelsey, damning information, and Tyler had given him nothing. The Queen had already made several moves that presaged trouble for the Church, beginning with a prescription on the use of underage clerical aides to satisfy tithing debts. Tyler, who had been one of these aides himself, had enjoyed his childhood, but he understood the argument. Not all priests were Father Allen. Now parishes would have to hire real aides, aides whose salaries would be paid from money already earmarked for the Arvath treasury. But worse had followed. The Queen had announced that the Church's property tax exemption would end in the coming year. Starting in January, the Church would have to pay tax on all of its holdings up and down the tierling, including the big prize, thousands of acres of high-producing farmland in the northern Almont. For the Arvath, this was a financial cataclysm.
With the help of her foul-mouthed but undeniably clever treasurer, the Queen had also preempted the Holy Father's protests by decreeing that the Crown's private land holdings would no longer be exempt either. The Queen would pay property tax alongside the Church, and the money would be earmarked for public works and social services. Without enforcement, these decrees would mean nothing. But from overheard conversation in the keep, Tyler also knew that the Queen and Arliss had begun to quietly convert a large portion of the Census Bureau over to the business of tax assessment and collection. It was a clever move. Census men were already entrenched in every village of the Tierling, tracking the population, and it would not be a stretch for them to track income as well. Arlan Thorne would have screamed bloody murder, but Thorne was nowhere to be found. And without him, the census was a far more malleable animal. There would be plenty of Crown employees to make sure that God's Church forked over every last pound due. This morning, word had gone like quicksilver through the halls of the dormitory level. They were all wanted in the chapel at 9 this evening. No one knew what it was about, but the Holy Father required every priest in the Arvath to be there. Such a gathering was unlike Cardinal Anders, who always worked in the shadows, meeting one-on-one, so that no one else knew his plans. Tyler sensed something terrible on the horizon. It was 8:30.
"I know that you know, priest."
Tyler jumped to his feet, knocking over the candle. He turned, and the mace was there, leaning against the wall beside his bookshelves.
"You know that I can't read."
Tyler stared at him, speechless and frightened. He had known that he was treading on thin ice the other day, jumping into the Queen's conversation, but he had been unable to watch the mace wriggle there like a hooked fish. And Tyler's move had worked, for the Queen had forgotten about the note. It was only when Tyler met the mace's gaze afterward that he saw fire, hell, murder.
"How did you find out?"
the mace asked. "I guessed."
"Who have you told?"
"No one." The mace straightened, and Tyler closed his eyes, trying to pray. The mace would kill him. And Tyler's last odd thought was that the man had done him a great honor by coming in person.
"I want you to teach me."
Tyler's eyes popped open.
"Teach you what?" "How to read."
Tyler glanced at the closed door of his room.
"How did you get in here? There's always another door."
Before Tyler could consider this idea, the mace darted forward, cat-like and silent. Tyler tensed, pressing backward against his chair. But the mace only grabbed the other chair from beside the bookshelves, placed it facing Tyler, and sat down, his expression truculent.
"Will you teach me?"
Tyler wondered what would happen if he refused. The mace had not come here to kill him, perhaps, but that could always change. The mace had joined Queen Elissa's guard at the age of 14, and now he was at least 40 years old. Illiteracy was a difficult thing for anyone to hide, but it must have been nearly impossible for a queen's guard. Still, the mace had gotten away with it all of these years. Tyler glanced down and saw something extraordinary. The mace's hand, resting on the arm of the chair, was trembling. A slight flutter that was almost imperceptible. As unbelievable as the idea seemed, Tyler realized that the mace was afraid.
"Of me?" "Of course not, you old fool."
"Then of what?" After another moment's thought, he knew. The mace couldn't bear to ask for help, not from anyone. Tyler stared, marveling at the terrifying man sitting across from him. The courage it must have taken him to come here. And before he knew it, the words were out.
"I'll teach you." "Good."
The mace leaned forward, businesslike.
"Let's start now."
"I can't," Tyler told him, lifting apologetic hands as the mace's expression darkened.
all of us are supposed to attend a meeting in the chapel at 9 o'clock.
He checked his watch. It was 9:15.
In fact, I should go now.
A meeting about what?
I don't know. The Holy Father demands the presence of every priest in the Avath.
Have there been many of these meetings?
This is the only one.
The mace's eyes narrowed.
Come back tomorrow, just after supper, 7 o'clock. We can start then.
The mace nodded.
Which chapel is this meeting in? The main, or the Holy Father's private?
The main,
Tyler replied, raising his eyebrows.
You know the Avath very well.
Of course I do.
A hint of contempt crept into the mace's voice.
It's my business to know of danger to my mistress.
What does that mean?
The mace went to Tyler's clothes rack and pulled a robe from its hook.
You're not a stupid man, priest. Pope and kings make poor bedfellows.
Tyler thought of the new appointees to the accounting office, men who looked more like criminal enforcers than priests of the Avath.
I'm only a bookkeeper.
Not any more.
The mace put on his weekend robe. Priests' robes were meant to fit loosely, but the material hung tight on the mace's huge frame.
You're the keep priest, Father. You can't avoid picking a side forever.
Tyler stared at him, unable to reply, as the mace ran his hand over the wall beside Tyler's desk. His hand stilled, then pressed hard, and Tyler's mouth dropped open as a door swung inward, a door whose edges had been cleverly concealed by the uneven mortar of the wall. The mace stepped into the darkness, then leaned back into Tyler's room, a twinkle of humour in his dark eyes.
7 o'clock tomorrow, Father. I will be here.
A moment later, there was nothing facing Tyler but a blank stone wall. The bell for convocation rang, and he jumped. He was going to be late. He grabbed one of his chapel robes and threw it over his head as he hurried down the hallway. The arthritis in his hip began clamouring, but Tyler ignored it, pushing himself harder. If he entered late, word would surely get back to the Holy Father. Hurrying through the door of the chapel, Tyler found his brother priests already assembled in long, straight rows on either side of the central aisle. Up on the dais, the Holy Father stood behind the podium, his sharp eyes seeming to burn through Tyler as he stood frozen in the doorway.
Ty!
He looked down and saw that Wide, sitting on the end of the last bench, had scooted over to make a space. Tyler gave him a grateful look as he squeezed in, bowing his head respectfully. But his unease persisted. The sight of Anders in the white robes was still a shock to Tyler. To him, and no doubt many of the older priests, the Holy Father was, and always would be, the old, shrunken man who now lay entombed beneath the Avath. Tyler didn't grieve the old Holy Father, but he couldn't deny that the man had left his mark on the place. He'd sat in the seat for too long. Anders held up his hands for silence, and the shuffling stopped. The room was as still as stone.
Brothers, we are not clean.
Tyler looked up sharply. Anders gazed across the room with a benevolent smile. A smile that suited a holy father. But his eyes were deep and dark, filled with a righteous fury that made Tyler's stomach tighten with anxiety.
Disease begins with contagion. God has demanded that we root out the contagion and eradicate the disease. My predecessor tolerated it, turning a blind eye. I will not.
Tyler and Wide stared at each other, bewildered.
The old Holy Father had tolerated many vices, certainly, but they seemed like the sort of vices that wouldn't bother Anders at all. Anders kept 2 private servants, young women who had been turned over to the Avath by their families in lieu of the tithe.
When Anders had moved into the Holy Father's lavish apartments in the pinnacle of the Arvath, the women had followed, even though the new residents came equipped with an army of acolytes ready to serve the Holy Father's every whim.